From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. It's quiet today at the Gallo Winery in Modesto, closed in honor of Ernest Gallo, who died this week. We'll talk about his big influence over both the wine business and Modesto today on Insight. Also today, why are we springing forward so soon this year? Daylight saving time starts Sunday morning, 3 weeks earlier than usual. We'll also talk about the technical snafus it's causing. Plus, painter and TV host Stefan Bauman, his show The Grand View takes PBS viewers to U.S. national parks. He's in Sacramento this weekend and you'll meet him on Insight. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, we remember Ernest Gallo, the wealthy Central Valley winemaker who died this week. We'll talk about his legacy in the wine business and the impact he had on his home city of Modesto. Also, San Francisco artist Stefan Bauman takes public TV viewers into national parks on his series The Grand View. You'll meet him later today. First, daylight saving time comes 3 weeks early this year. Sunday morning at 2 a.m., we need to put our clocks forward an hour. The goal is supposedly energy conservation, but Congress has reserved the right to shift daylight saving time back to its normal starting date if insufficient energy is saved. A little later, we'll talk with a technology expert about some of the glitches the daylight saving change has caused. But first, let's find out if daylight saving time actually does save energy. Joining us is Bob Aldrich of the California Energy Commission. Bob, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Why is daylight saving time starting so early this year?
Well, it was an act of Congress. In 2005, the National Energy Policy Act changed daylight saving time ostensibly to help us save additional energy from what daylight saving time does already.
Why do we have daylight saving time at all?
Well, it goes back many, many years, as far back as Benjamin Franklin, really. Benjamin Franklin, when he was ambassador to France, wrote a very funny essay talking about saving candles, saving the tallow for candles. And that was kind of forgotten for many years until William Willett in England petitioned the House of Commons to have a change in the time in England so that people would not be sleeping in with their window shades drawn in the morning when the sun was already up. So from there, it went into World War I. Germany changed its clock to save energy during the war. England followed suit. The United States followed England. And then World War II, again, we turned our clocks ahead to save energy during World War II. Then there was nothing that regulated daylight saving time across the United States. There were communities and cities that changed their clocks if they wanted to, and there was no rhyme or reason across the country. You'd have to change your clock just crossing a city border, change your watch. So Congress in 1966 passed the Uniform Time Act, which basically said that anyone could observe daylight saving time. It just had to be uniform across the country.
Yesterday evening on an NPR news program, I heard an interview with a man who's written a book, and he says that it's a bunch of baloney, that it saves energy, that it's just a big corporate conspiracy, daylight saving time. How do we know daylight saving time actually saves energy?
Well, you can look at the patterns of energy usage through the daytime, and we've actually have run a model looking at energy saving for this early start of daylight saving time. So we looked at energy usage for the last, or for about 5 or 6 years, and then in the model shifted what time daylight saving time would go into effect. And the model shows us saving about 3% off of our peak electricity usage. Now, overall, we might see a little increase in the morning, which might offset that. So we don't really know whether or not there will be an actual overall energy saving. But just dropping the peak down is good because that's the time when we need the most energy in California and the rest of the country.
So we don't know if there'll actually be a savings in energy.
That's true. And we'll have to wait and see. You know, in a couple of years, we'll run the numbers, see if there was actually. And that's why Congress put that little caveat in there, being able to say that we'll change it back if we don't save any more additional energy.
But if it's been talked about since the time of Benjamin Franklin and it's been done in many countries for many decades, don't we know for certain by now?
Well, We note that daylight saving time does save energy. It depends on whether or not our time in the morning is going to increase. Also, you have to understand that since the studies were done in the 70s and even back with William Willett, our lives have changed dramatically. We have gone have more electronics in our house. We have a totally different way of using energy. We're not burning oil, for example, to produce electricity, at least in California. And so those savings might not be there, depending on how we look at it. So,
does the California Energy Commission have a position on this?
Well, no, not really a position. We're just hopeful that it will save energy. But, you know, quite frankly, the easiest way to save energy is just walk up to your nearest lamp, unscrew that incandescent light bulb, and put a compact fluorescent light bulb in that lamp. That's going to save much more energy than daylight saving time. As a matter of fact, if every home in California changed an incandescent for a compact fluorescent, we would save $75 million, and the equivalent of about 85,000 cars would be taken off the road in a year, that amount of carbon dioxide that those cars produce.
We're talking about the new early daylight saving time that starts on Sunday morning. Bob Aldrich is a spokesperson with the California Energy Commission. Also with us, Mike Dillon, Chief Technology Officer at Quest Technologies. It's a Sacramento-based technology management company. Mike, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
How is the change in daylight saving time affecting computers and other machines?
Well, right now, there's just a lot of work. We won't really know until Sunday on how it's going to impact it. We have had a lot of patches. A lot of people are out there trying to load things up. A lot
patches
of different vendors.
Fixes to
operating system patches, yes. And a lot of vendors haven't really tested things out well. Even to this past week, we've had people who have come out and said, well, that patch wasn't the right one. You're going to use this one now. And so different IT people are out there trying to load different systems, and we're hoping and crossing our fingers that Sunday's going to be okay.
Is everyone getting to this a bit late?
Yes, there's no doubt. There's no doubt from the business side and from the vendor side that everyone's late. I've had people even as early as last week going, we have to worry about patches on our computers this week? Yes, we do.
Well, it's one thing for most of us to not even think about this and not care about it. But surely companies like yours and software providers like Microsoft and Apple, I mean, they must have been working on this for a long time, surely.
I don't know how long they've been working on it, but Microsoft just came out around end of January and even up until even a couple weeks ago with the patches for all of their systems. And it's not even patches for all of their systems. A lot of them are still manual processes. So if you're on what they call Microsoft 2000, it's going to be a manual process. There won't be a patch unless you pay Microsoft something.
Meaning what? It's not an automatic update.
Correct. Unless you go out special. A lot of these operating systems aren't supported anymore. So Microsoft has come out and said, for instance, once again, Microsoft 2000, it's not supported unless you buy a special support package. And that's about $4,000 or $5,000.
Now, Bob, how much timeline was there for people to get ready for this? It was 2005.
That's right. The law was signed into effect in August of 2005 by President Bush. And so we've had since then to get ready, almost like the Y2K. Of course, we knew a lot more with Y2K and had a much longer lead time for Y2K. But yeah, it is a problem. I just had to have my computers in the office and my PDA updated just this last week.
Yeah. Mike, how complicated is it to make this patch to update Windows XP and other operating systems so that they can change daylight saving time 3 weeks early? I mean, we're just basically asking it to do the same thing but on a different date.
Well, that's true. It's not complicated to upload a patch, but Microsoft has come out with plenty of patches. The challenge, though, is that when you're dealing with time, it interchanges between different systems and different applications. So, for instance, your schedule on your PDA has to sync up with your schedule back on your email system back at work. So it's just not one patch for that to happen. There's multiple patches.
What advice would you give people who are having problems right now with their computers that are related to that? And let me give you an example.
Sure.
I'm troubled by this every day with my computer here in our studio. We use Outlook Calendar to schedule our future topics. And the topics starting Monday are spread over 2 days instead of being an all-day event, which is what we make everything. And we've been told it's because of the daylight savings time, saving time matter. And we're just sort of hoping that when we come in Monday, it'll all be fixed.
Wow. There are, with Outlook specifically and with Exchange specifically, you have to take through a manual process to get that updated now.
I see.
And if you don't go through some of that now, you are waiting until Monday and see what's going to happen.
Wow.
Ouch.
It's, I kind of think Monday should be the no like whining day.
Yes.
There should be patient, and we've all known about it, but the fact is, like we've talked about here, it just hasn't been taken quite with emphasis as like year 2000.
Are you and your staff expecting more calls on your pagers and emergency emails on Sunday and
yes.
Monday?
Yeah, we're 7x24. So Sunday, we're expecting to have, or we're going to have more like people there on Sunday than we would like normally have on like Sunday. And to give me an example, BlackBerry. So everyone has a BlackBerry. A call into BlackBerry this past week, you'd have been on hold for about 2 or 3 hours. Normally, that's about 3 or 4 minutes. So a lot of people were calling into BlackBerry just this week asking, what do I do? This doesn't seem to be working. Why?
Now, what about people with Windows XP, which is a very common operating system on computers here and probably around the world, I guess. Is there anything that someone with Windows XP needs to be doing today or before Sunday night, or is this an automatic process?
Well, I'd always suggest that you look at your patches updates anyway. So if you're up to date, most systems come with that default on. So unless you've done something, you shouldn't have to worry about it. The problem is if that's a consumer. In business, people want to take control of their own patches. So you'd have to work with your IT on when they're doing that patch update.
And if you've somehow disabled that automated portion of your computer, you need to find your own personal Mike Dillon, I guess.
Yeah, you do. Once again, there's no whining on like Monday.
I promise. Now, Bob, should we do daylight saving time year-round? If it turns out that it saves energy during the summer, is it fair to think that it would also save energy in the winter?
Well, California looked at that during our electricity crisis of 2001. And what California did is we petitioned Congress through legislation, a Senate joint resolution, Congress and the White House, to allow California to go to year-round daylight saving time to help us save energy. And yes, in fact, our studies then back in 2001 said that we would save more energy year-round. And so it's a possibility. It would just be up to the state to ask Congress if we to go year-round daylight saving time.
But is there someone or something that would lose out if we were to do that?
Well, certainly the industries such as the airline industry and people who have schedules and farmers, for example, they might not enjoy having that different change in or not having that change in time.
Why? Wouldn't it be easier without the change?
Well, yes, but everybody else will be changing back from daylight saving to standard time. So if we're the oddball out, then it might make it a little bit more difficult.
You mean other states or other countries?
Other countries, other states. Canada, for example, is going early this year with early daylight saving time. Mexico is not. Mexico is staying, will start the first week of April.
It seems like it's always a bit of a mess anyway, isn't it? Because my mother lives in Scotland, and we always have this thing, even before this year, of when the daylight savings starts, or British summertime, as they call it there.
I know. It's an amazing thing to try to keep in mind and remember, spring forward, fall back. But, you know, there's another mnemonic people should remember is change your clock, change your batteries. Because this is also the time of year that people should consider and remember to change their smoke alarm batteries. We had a fire not too long ago here in Sacramento where a family perished, and that was because they didn't have a smoke alarm. So if you have a smoke alarm, change your battery. Just remember when you change your clock, change your batteries.
Mike, what happens? Let's say Congress decides didn't work. Let's go back to the old-fashioned daylight saving time, so the computers need to go back to the way they were. Is that going to be a big hassle as well?
Well, I would imagine, depending on the year, if it's 5 years out or next year, people might not have patched them come into next year, so it might not be an issue. It will be a hassle going back and forth. It's not fun doing patches. If you could imagine a company with 100 servers and they haven't done testing, like your example of your schedule, and here comes a bunch of patches down again, to take those systems down to load any patch is always like a challenge. So to do it twice a year, to do this major shift back and forth is going to be a hassle.
Could operating systems be designed so that they can more easily switch from one daylight saving time or any time change from one to another?
Yes, that's the way they have set up. They have gotten through this, you know, about 10 or 15 years ago. This used to be just a terrible day. But here in the past 10 or so years, systems have been able to switch back and forth without any challenges.
Mm. And finally, Bob, daylight saving time this year will be more than half the year. How can standard time be standard if it's less than half the year?
Very good point. That's a good question. Maybe we should call that early time instead of daylight saving time or daylight wasting time in the evening. So, but at least at the end, kids will have an extra hour to go trick-or-treating come November, because the clocks will change back to standard time the first Sunday of November instead of the first Sunday of October.
Very good. Well, thank you both. Bob Aldrich, spokesperson with the California Energy Commission, and Mike Dillon, Chief Technology Officer at Quest Technologies, a Sacramento-based technology management company. Thanks both.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, we remember Ernest Gallo, the wealthy Central Valley winemaker who died this week. We'll talk about his legacy in the wine business and the impact he had on his home city of Modesto. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. It's quiet today at the Gallo Winery in Modesto. The offices and production lines are closed in honor of co-founder Ernest Gallo, who died this week, aged 97. The company's other founder, Giulio Gallo, died in 1993. The Gallo Wine Company, or E&J Gallo Winery, grew to become the world's largest. It's a big and influential employer in Modesto. And the wealthy Gallo family is also an important institution in the city. Today, we're going to talk about Ernest Gallo, the family company, and their impact on Modesto. Our first guest is a nephew of Ernest Gallo and an important winemaker in his own right. He's Frank Franzia, CEO of Bronco Wine Company, based in Ceres. Frank, welcome to Insight.
First of all, it's Fred, not Frank.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Fred. That's I misread. Okay. That's my mistake. I do apologize.
That's all right.
Fred, how would you describe Ernest Gallo? What are the first words that come to mind when you think about him?
Well, extremely successful and extremely fair person. I knew him more on a social basis because I used to enjoy having dinners at his house and debate a lot of topics. So I saw a different dimension of him than most people.
Now, he and Giulio divided up responsibilities in the business. Could you tell us what Ernest did at the winery and what Giulio did?
Well, I don't know if two, it's, you know, like a husband and wife, what do they really split up? They both have a common goal of getting the job done. I think they divided up from what I read by Ernest managing the sales side of it and Giulio the production side, but I think they both worked at both of them equally.
Yes. Was he a demanding man?
You know, demanding, if you own a business, you make demands on yourself more than you make demands on anyone else. I think it just comes with the territory.
Yes. Could you tell us what he enjoyed doing besides work? I've heard that he worked very hard, long hours, which I guess is inevitable when you're building a large business. But just so that we can understand a bit more about Ernest Gallo, the man.
Well, I think he enjoyed eating, and that's, you know, and like everyone does. But I think that you know, to a person like himself or myself to run your own business, it isn't work. It's not something you try to avoid. It's something you do, and I think he just gets consumed with the success of his companies as he built them over the years, and it just is his way of life. It's no other way of describing. It's not work to him.
Now, your wine company has many, you make and sell many types of wine, but perhaps the most well-known is the Charles Shaw, which is commonly known as Two Buck Chuck. And there are definitely other wineries in California who didn't like that approach. They thought you were devaluing wine. What did Ernest Gallo make of your approach to the wine business, or what would he have made of it?
Well, he did make it. He had no problem with it. I mean, he saw the success of the program. He saw the good value to the consumers. And it certainly is a legacy he left behind, is to give good quality at a reasonable price. And that's the approach we took with the Charles Shaw. And 72 million people are drinking it last year. We sold 72 million bottles, so must be something right about it.
And what do you, as a professional, successful winemaker yourself, how do you evaluate the E&J Gallo Winery and the wines that they made?
I think that they've done an exceptional job. I certainly haven't been there in the beginning, but from what I hear from my parents and from knowing what you hear, they took the business as well as the whole rest of the industry. And from zero, if you have to take a number, when Prohibition ended, to where today people are drinking a bottle of wine per capita per month. You know, I'd like to see it get to a bottle every day for everyone. Mm. So we got a lot of work ahead of us. But moving it from zero to one is the hardest job.
Yes, and you would say that that's what Ernest and Julio did.
Well, I think they get it, and they built the operation's been running for the last 10 years with the next generation of leadership there. And I think probably the biggest legacy that Ernest did is developing his son and his nephews, Bob and Joe Gallo, to be able to run this operation. They have been running it.
And is there reason to think that the E&J Gallo Winery will continue to thrive?
It will continue to thrive.
Okay.
There's no doubt about it in my mind, because the people that are running it today are the same people running it 10 years ago, for the last 10 years.
I've heard rumors that some members of the Gallo family might want to move the headquarters to Sonoma County. Have you heard that? Do you think that's likely?
No, it'll never move. The Modesto's home base to the family. It's their center of their gravity, and the Sonoma operation is just what it is. It's a small part of their total picture.
Well, Fred Franzia, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
That's Fred Franzia, nephew of Ernest Gallo and owner of the Bronco Wine Company in Ceres. Bronco itself is one of the largest wine companies in the U.S. In our studio, two guests to continue this discussion. The first is Tim Moran, the staff reporter at the Modesto Bee. Tim, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
How important is E&J Gallo Winery to Modesto?
Oh, it's huge. It's, I believe, the biggest private employer in town. They employ 3,000 people. It just has a huge economic impact on this town.
Yes. How important is it? The actual headquarters is in Modesto. That's important in itself, separate from the production.
Yeah.
Lines.
Well, it really put Modesto on the map over the last 40 years. You can go into any town in the United States and find a product that was made in Modesto, and it says that on the label. And so having the headquarters there is just a big advantage, I think.
It would be quite a different city without the Gallo Winery, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and another aspect is, because it's the home city for the winery, there's a lot of philanthropy that the Gallo family does. There's a Gallo Center for the Performing Arts being built downtown now.
And we'll talk a bit more about the Gallo family, but let's bring into the discussion Mike Dunn, who's food and wine critic at the Sacramento Bee. Mike, welcome back to Insight.
Yeah, glad to be back.
E&J Gallo Winery has obviously been a very successful business and still is, but how good a winery is it?
It's a very good winery. It has a reputation of early on in its history of making inexpensive, simple wines, but Ernest Gallo had a philosophy of catering to the American palate. The American palate liked its beverages sweet, carbonated, simple, fruity, and he catered to that initially. But as Americans developed a more, say, refined palate, he was right in step with that and encouraged extensive plantings of really high-quality vineyards in Sonoma County and elsewhere in California.
To what extent did the Gallo Winery shape the American wine palate and guide it, or was the company itself shaped and guided by the American wine palate?
I think it was a case of Ernest Gallo and his marketing acumen just had a sense of what Americans wanted in the way of beverage, especially when it comes to wine. And then he anticipated these tastes and built on that and came up with products and just kept in step with the changing American palate. And as it matured, Gallo matured and came up with finer and finer wines.
1933 was a funny time to start a winery. Ernest and Julio must have been doing their research while Prohibition was the law.
Yeah, well, they had there were other family members, grandparents who had been involved in the wine business before Ernest and Julio. They grew grapes. They shipped wine during Prohibition. Americans could make home wine, 200 gallons a year. They catered to that clientele. That's how Ernest and Julio got involved in the wine trade, and then they were ready to really expand very fast, very aggressively when Prohibition ended.
Yeah. Tim Moran, how much of a presence in Modesto was Ernest Gallo in later years? Now, he was 97 when he died, just days, I think, before his 98th birthday.
Yeah, that's right. He actually, in the last year or two, he wasn't seen much, but in past years, you know, well into his 90s, you could see him. He'd come to the public farmer's market. He'd have kind of an entourage around him, and he would show up occasionally here and there. And they told us, you know, even after he was no longer running the winery, he would come to his office several days a week into his 90s and kind of make sure everything was running to his satisfaction.
It's a big family nowadays, the Gallo family, and a very wealthy family. The Forbes billionaire list was just published today or yesterday, and Ernest Gallo, because he died obviously before the after the list was prepared, was relatively high on the list. How active are the Gallo family in Modesto? How much of a presence are they in Modesto?
Well, it's funny because people probably don't recognize them. Somebody mentioned they saw a picture of Joe Gallo, Ernest's son, in the paper and said, well,
he's the CEO of the company now.
He's the CEO. And somebody said, well, I've seen him around. They just didn't know who it was. But like I said, they're very involved in charities and things like that. And but you don't – they're very publicity shy. So you don't normally – hear of them, I guess. And a lot of times the money they give is with the stipulation that they not be identified.
Yes. So. Yeah, you when I think about reading news stories about the Gallo company, you rarely see quotes from anyone who's close to the company other than maybe a generic comment from a public information person. Is that your experience, even as someone who's a reporter for the newspaper of record in Modesto, the hometown of the Gallo Winery and the Gallo family?
That's true, and it's been frustrating. It's changed a bit since Matt and Gina Gallo have become more public figures in the Sonoma operation, and Stephanie Gallo is a marketing director for the Family Vineyards line, and she's been a little bit more accessible. In today's paper, she did kind of a question and answer with us, but typically the family doesn't like to be quoted in the paper.
And it's a private company, of course, so I guess They don't need to speak to anyone.
Yeah.
Mike Dunn, I don't know if you can tell us anything about this, but the brother Joseph died just a few weeks ago. He was 87, the younger brother of Ernest and Julio. Now, he fell out with Ernest and Julio over a dispute over cheese labels. Are you familiar with that?
Well, yes. Joseph Gallo, well before he established his dairy and his cheese business, was not interested in so much in the winery. He went off and did his own thing, and he developed this dairy, this cheese business, and he was using his name, Joseph Gallo Farms, on the cheese. And his brothers were always very protective of the Gallo name. They would sue if anyone infringed, or they felt was somebody was infringing on their trademark, their name. including their brother, and they took him to court, and it was quite protracted. And I do think that they won that, the brother, Ernest and Julio, won that dispute.
Yes. And but, of course, they had their own issue with that. The Kendall Jackson, the winery, sued the Gallows over the Turning Leaf label.
Turning Leaf, because the label was so similar to Kendall Jackson's label. So they were on the other end of the litigation as well.
Now, earlier I talked with Fred Franzia of the Bronco Wine Company, and he's certainly a feisty guy. He has basically been quite aggressive in the marketing of wine, bringing the prices down, using whatever grapes he felt like were necessary to make his wines. What do you think Ernest and Julio Gallo would make of that behind closed doors? Do you think they would be going, yeah, go for it, Fred? Or do you think they would have shared the concerns other California wineries had, which was that you're messing with a good product here and you're undermining it?
No, I think that I think they would have been supportive of what Fred did, because it was expanding the audience for wine. It was helping farmers. It was at a time when there was a glut and something had to be done to assure the livelihood of farmers. So Fred stepped up, and Ernest and Julio had done that since the 30s. You know, that one time in the 50s, they were buying something like 40% of the fruit that was being grown in the Napa Valley.
A little while ago, we talked about the Gallo Center for the Arts in Modesto, the other most famous name in California wine, who also has an art center named after him and his wife, is Robert Mondavi. Do you know how Ernest and Julio Gallo got on with Robert Mondavi?
Well, they were rivals early on, and I don't think they saw eye to eye, because Robert Mondavi, at the outset, at least, and for most of his career, was really focused on premium wines, expensive wines. And Ernest and Julio were more—they looked upon wine as kind of a commodity product. So they were rivals. They didn't see eye to eye. But as time went on, they became closer and ended up as friends. I was talking with Robert Mondavi a few years ago, and the restaurant Biba came up, and Robert Mondavi said he'd never been there, and he said, "Well, I've got to go to that restaurant when I'm in Sacramento one of these days. My friend Ernest tells me about it. He's been there often."
Yes. And Tim Moran, finally to you, basically reposing a question I had for Fred Franzia, and that was the rumors that I've heard that the younger generations of Gallos might want to move the headquarters to Sonoma County. Have you heard those rumors? What do you think about them?
Well, I've heard the rumors, and in fact, we asked Stephanie Gallo that in today's paper, and she said that's not going to happen. They have so much in Modesto. It's such a huge complex, and they have, you know, the automated warehouses and all that stuff there and the headquarters. It would be a massive task to move it, I think. And they're so identified with Modesto, I think it would be difficult for them to want to do that.
Mike?
Yeah, could I ask a question of Tim? Is it true that the Gallo headquarters still doesn't have a sign that says Gallo?
That's true. There's a sign on the glass plant that says Gallo, and there's a sign on the Founders Building. But other than that, there are no
Gallo names. It's a
very
low-key place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you could drive by it and not know what's there.
There's a probably apocryphal story where somebody said to Ernest, you know, that why don't you have your name on any of the buildings? And he said, I know where they are.
Right.
And Mike, final question for you. What do you think are the prospects for E&J Gallo Winery? It was for a long time the world's largest wine company, but it was recently overtaken by another company, some mergers elsewhere. In any case, it's a huge company and a very successful company. Do you see the future belonging to Gallo?
Well, it's a very competitive wine industry, and Gallo is right up there with Constellation. They're kind of going back and forth as to who is number one and number two. I think domestically, domestic sales, Gallo is still number one. Constellation is bigger on a global scale.
I see.
But no, I think the future of Gallo is as bright now as it has ever been. They reinvent themselves. They have been doing that since day one, and they're continuing to do it. They're just very smart when it comes to farming practices, marketing practices, and I don't see any cracks in that foundation.
We've been talking today about Ernest Gallo, one of the founders of E&J Gallo Winery, based in Modesto. He died earlier this week, aged 97. My guests, Tim Moran of the Modesto Bee and Mike Dunn of the Sacramento Bee. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, painter and TV host Stefan Bauman. His show, The Grand View, takes PBS viewers to U.S. national parks. He's in Sacramento this weekend. You'll meet him when we return. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Last Wednesday, we looked into the HPV vaccine. It can help protect girls and women against a virus that can lead to cervical cancer. A California bill would require all preteen girls to get the HPV shots. We heard from several listeners. One objected to my use of the phrase cervical vaccine, and rightly so. That was my mistake. I should have said cervical cancer vaccine. Best, though, is to just call it what it is, the HPV vaccine. Another listener who identified him or herself as B emailed us to say, if this disease is transmitted through sex, is the male the carrier of this virus? If so, what about a vaccine for the male population? Good questions, I think. And Forrest in Sacramento wrote about the controversy over requiring preteen girls to get the vaccine. He said all California children are required to have a hepatitis B vaccine, and it can be sexually transmitted. Thank you all for writing. Our email address is insight@capradio.org. San Francisco painter Stefan Bauman takes people into national parks on his public TV series, The Grand View. Bauman describes his show as both a travel show and an inspirational show. In each program, he does a painting on location. Stefan Bauman is in Sacramento this weekend. He's giving a talk and demonstration in El Dorado Hills on Saturday. This afternoon, he's in our studio. Stefan Bauman, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
How did you get started making TV programs and doing paintings in national parks?
Well, it all started about 20 years ago when I took a group of artists to Yosemite National Park. And we basically had such a great time that we thought we'd like to share it with more people. And that concept just grew and grew until we actually decided to take it on to PBS.
Now, you're a painter. Are you a painter who just happens to go to national parks and paints the scenery? Or do you have a long-standing interest in being in the outdoors, being in wilderness and other natural areas?
Well, I was born and raised in Lake Tahoe and in 1962. And in the process of growing up there, I saw a lot happen to the lake. And I, at that point, decided that if somebody didn't make a stand for nature, that a lot of these places would disappear. So as I grew up, I became very, very aware of saving our national parks.
And how did you decide that your paintings could help?
Well, part of that was the artwork that I was doing dealt with a lot of the national parks. A lot of my paintings are of Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, and Yosemite. Also, what I found is that throughout our travels, we would actually go there. When we started to do the research for the PBS show, we realized that there was no other show on PBS that actually took people to the national parks. And what we found, what was really interesting, is that most people, when you ask them how many national parks there are, they can name 4, 5, 6 at most.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't realize is that there's actually over 380 national parks.
That's a lot of TV programs you could make.
We'll be on the air for a while.
Seriously, are you planning to visit all or at least most of them?
Well, we'd like to visit all. I mean, one of our campaigns is to go to a lot of the national parks that a lot of people don't know of. Some of the national parks that we visit are Devil's Postpile or Lassa National Park. So we do go to the Grand Canyon, Yosemite, but our mission is actually to bring more of the intimate parks to the American public.
Stefan Bauman is an artist and host, producer, and director of The Grand View on PBS, a travel show that features America's national parks. it can be the program can be seen in the Sacramento TV market on KVIE2. That's Comcast 7, and it airs Tuesday evenings at 6, and a different episode the next day, the Wednesday at 8 o'clock. We have a couple of your paintings on our webpage, capradio.org/insight, and one of them is Vernal Falls. That would be the famous waterfall in Yosemite, I guess.
Yes, Vernal Falls is actually a composition that I visit a lot. In fact, I just completed a large piece that's actually 4 feet by 6 feet of Vernal Falls. I find as an art piece, it's almost a perfect composition. For those people who have never hiked up to Vernal Falls, the Mist Trail is one of the most unique and spectacular trails in all of the national parks, especially in springtime. It really is a life-changing experience to go up to Vernal Falls.
How many times have you painted it?
I've probably painted it about 25 times.
My goodness.
Yeah.
On 25 quite separate occasions or several paintings in one go?
Well, part of what I actually do is paint on location. So a lot of the sketches I actually do in about 2 hours right there on the spot in the park. Then a lot of these become sketches for larger canvases in my studio.
So this painting that we can see at capradio.org/insight, was how did you make this? Was this sketches at the waterfall and then fleshed out as a painting in your studio?
Yes. For the most part, the initial painting, this particular painting actually started, it's an 18 by 24 inches, and it actually started on location, and then I took that sketch and worked it on in my studio.
It's a beautiful painting. Now, I don't paint, so my opinions on this aren't worth a whole lot, but it seems to me that painting something that moves to the extent that a waterfall does is a challenge.
It is a challenge to try to capture that. What's even more of a challenge is to try to capture that sense of place. A lot of artists that when they paint trying to recreate the image, much like a photograph. What we actually try to do with our lectures is give the power to create, where we actually focus in on what it's like to be in a place and try to translate that into art.
Give us an idea of how you do that. How does an artist do that?
Well, part of that is to be very aware of yourself. When you're actually there in a place, you try to capture the essence of the park the way that it feels, which is an entirely different thing about the way that it looks. So you have to be very conscious of the temperature, lighting, just actually even be aware of the sounds that nature is making and try to recreate that. And a lot of times you can recreate those feelings by actually being in the place while you're painting it.
It looks to me like the waterfall is moving. How do you do that? Is that a visual trick, or is it just how it naturally comes out when you paint it accurately?
Well, it can be a visual trick. I mean, basically, again, part of our talk is that art is purely an illusion. I mean, it doesn't really exist. It's the same way as a photograph with a photograph. All what paintings do is stimulate the mind. And what we actually do doesn't really exist. It's just paint on canvas. If you can trigger people's memories of waterfalls, that's how the feeling actually becomes real.
Now, the waterfall is moving as it does all the time, and so you can perhaps capture what that looks like and recreate that. But the shaft of sunlight that's cast across part of this picture on a diagonal, the sun is moving all the time, and then the sun disappears. That literally does change all of the time. How can you hold on to that memory and put it onto the canvas when you get back to your studio?
Well, that's kind of what we actually portray in our television show. When we're actually filming on location, we do the painting over a 4-hour period. That's because usually when we're in the national parks, we have to deal with Harleys driving through the parks and planes and tourists. When I paint outdoors for my own artwork, I'm usually out there for about 2 hours. And within those 2 hours, all kinds of effects happen. A lot of times wildlife will actually appear, light changes constantly. The water patterns change, like in this waterfall scene here that we're looking at. When you're actually out there painting in the moment, you actually make footnotes of all those ideas. And then it takes an artist to actually filter a lot of those ideas to put together the original.
The shaft of sunlight is perfectly placed from an aesthetic point of view. It's just in this ideal location. But it would take a long time to paint that portion. I wonder what happens when you just see this perfect moment. And if you were a photographer, you could just capture that moment and you don't need to adapt. But as the sun moves, by the time you're not even finished painting that portion that is so beautifully illuminated by the sun, it's now in shadow. How do you compensate for that when you're painting on location?
Well, a lot of that is actually you have to recall it. Yep. You have to you put footnotes down, and then you'll have to memorize that. When we filmed the TV show, we start at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we shoot pretty much straight through till about 10 o'clock. Well, the brushstrokes that we're doing at the end of the painting demonstration on television, they're actually recreating brushstrokes, lighting effects that we saw at the beginning. And it's up to the artist to actually memorize all of the effects, and then they put them in as they go.
Artist Stefan Baumann is the host and producer and director of The Grand View, a public TV program. It can be seen in the Sacramento area. He lives in San Francisco, but he's in Sacramento for an event tomorrow evening in El Dorado Hills to benefit the El Dorado Arts Council. There must be challenges sometimes in painting on location because the national parks are wild places and sometimes it can rain or snow. Or do you just have to make sure you do it in the summertime and hope that it doesn't even rain then?
Well, one of the biggest challenges actually are the tourists. And when people actually see our show, they actually think that we have the park to ourselves. The biggest challenge is actually being able to set up in some of these places where tourist buses stop and the people come out to take pictures. The rest of the time, artists tend to either dress warm or they'll have all kinds of gear that makes it a little bit easier. A lot of times we'll actually paint in snowstorms or rainstorms.
I was thinking about your canvas. I mean, obviously the artist's comfort is a factor, but I was wondering about the canvas being or the paint being destroyed or damaged in some way.
Well, the great thing about working with oil paints is water and oil don't mix.
Oh, yes.
So a lot of times I'll actually be painting in a rainstorm and pushing paint around, and the water is mixing in with the oil, and it can get quite sticky. But for the most part, artists that work outdoors tend to be fair weather artists. They like to get up at 10 or 11 on really nice days and conclude about dinner time.
And that's you?
No. I'm usually up early in the morning. I want to get there before the tourists are there.
Sure.
So I'm up there usually about 5 in the morning.
And when you're doing this, you have a camera crew with you when you're painting on location for the Grand View.
When we shoot for the Grand View, we do shoot with a camera crew. Some of the locations that we've hiked into, like in Kings Canyon, we've hiked in 17 miles into locations that... and what we try to do with the TV show is bring areas of the parks that normally people don't see.
Very quickly, Stefan, what's your favorite national park?
Oh, I'm asked that all the time. My favorite, I would have to say, is Yosemite. Yosemite. Well, I was born and raised in Lake Tahoe, and the Sierras are very dear to me. Yosemite is just breathtaking. It is truly a magical place, and I find a lot of my compositions always bring me back to Yosemite.
Surely. If you want more information about Stefan Baumann's event tomorrow evening in El Dorado Hills, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. There's information including a telephone number. Again, he's the host also of The Grand View, the public TV show. It can be seen on KVIE. And Stefan, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
That's Stefan Baumann. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, many people in Singapore speak a local variation of English. It's called Singlish. We learn why this local mix of English, Chinese, and Malay is popular with Singapore's people, but not with Singapore's leaders. That story in the day's news next on The World. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producer was Rosalind Gottfried. Our technical director is Mark Jones, acting assistant producer Natalie Breen, and senior producer is Jen Picard. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thank you for joining us. It's the 20th anniversary of light rail in Sacramento. On the next Insight, experts tell you about the history of light rail here and what the future holds. Plus, hear why the city's streetcar system was shut down 60 years ago. Also, Hillbilly Jazz is coming to the Woodland Opera House. Hear the Washboard Wizards perform live in our studio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Monday afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.